So today our subject of discussion is Vivekananda's vision of an ideal society. So now when we think about Swami Vivekananda as a spiritual seeker, as a prophet of Vedanta, say who revived the Vedantic tradition in modern times, we frequently consider his contribution to sociology or the concept of nation building as something secondary. But when we read his lectures and writings, his ideas and his own observations of European society, American society, and Indian society in the later half of 19th century, there are many, many ideas which seem to be very, very relevant, almost surprising. Just to give an idea, for example, when Vivekananda was traveling in Europe, in Eastern Europe especially, he makes a statement: today's Europe is sitting on the top of a volcano. And within a few years, very short period, the First World War started. The assassination of the Archduke and the subsequent First World War with Turkey, Germany, and other Axis powers on the one side, and in America, America joined later, Britain, France, and other countries on the other side. So this started in 1914. Within less than maybe 15 years, or less than 15 years after Vivekananda made this observation. He says that today's Eastern Europe has become a military barracks. He was referring to the Balkans. Literally, it was happening. Every nation in Europe was modernizing their infantries. Some of them even had already started artillery formations. Trench warfare was being seriously contemplated. All this were happening when Vivekananda was traveling in the Balkans. Another very interesting incident, of course. He says in one context that he could see the emergence of China and Russia from the shackles of dictatorship and imperial tyranny. So he made the statement there was practically no hope for the Tsarist Russia. It was under Nicholas II. It was going through one of its darkest periods in the history of the Romanov dynasty. And within a few years, 6 years of Swamiji's statement, the first Russian Revolution, major revolution, 1905, took place, and later on in 1917, February, there was a revolution, and in October, there was a famous Bolshevik Revolution. That is the end of the Romanovs in Russia. The end of monarchy, and that practically brought in a new era of concept of human government, anarchy, dictatorship, revolution, and so on. And these observations about the impact of French Revolution, the influence of the American War of Independence between the colonies and the British Crown under George III, and how it influenced the political thinking, many political ideas, in the first half of 19th century, utopian socialism, and eventually the Marxist Marxist political ideology. So there are many wonderful statements in Vivekananda's literature. You have to think of an intellectual who was educated in the best conceivable school of modern education in humanities. And along with that, he had also imbibed the cream of India's spiritual heritage, was familiar with Sanskrit literature. Now, I can give, for example, there are quite a few quotations which are very, very, very radical in their approach. And remember, Vivekananda was a great upholder of tradition, spiritual conservatism, not conservatism at the sociological level, but conservatism, orthodoxy at the spiritual level, the need to preserve traditional spiritual values. He insisted again and again. And along with that, he also makes statements which are very radical, which modern Marxists would be very happy if they could have included in their books, but they didn't have the political insight to include. To give an example, I'm a socialist not because it's a perfect system, but because half a loaf is better than no bread. You can think of the reach of the statement. And remember, you know, when Swamiji went to school, I mean the Scottish College and later Presidency College, Marxian ideas, not Marxian political ideas, mind you, you have to make a clear distinction between this. Marx would not have dreamt of a thing like October Revolution or what happened in China under the name of Cultural Revolution or Vietnam or Korea. He would not have even dreamt of, he would have disowned everything. What I'm talking about, some of Marxian humanistic ideas, socio-economic political thought systems that actually he inaugurated in 19th century Europe, especially the middle part of 19th century Europe. As an impact of his, you know, British Parliament enacted new amendments in the Constitution to prevent prevent a possible revolution in Britain, because Marx predicted the first revolution could take place either in Germany or in Britain. I mean, and he predicted that a revolution could happen only in a highly industrialized society. So he even pinpointed the place Manchester, Newcastle, Ruhr, I mean Germany, the important center of the iron coal industry. See, these were the places where Marx predicted a revolution could happen, because he was very sure that a revolution could not happen in an agrarian society or a non-industrialized society. So these are some of the statements of Swamiji. And Swamiji says, I am socialist not because it's a perfect system, but because half a loaf is better than no bread. To understand the impact, the relevance of this statement, if you are interested, not in history, but in English literature, you can read Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist, where he asked, sir, I want a little more, asking for more soup in the workhouse. The orphan asking for a little more soup. Or you can read Nicholas Nickleby, Old Curiosity Shop. All these, I'm not talking about history books, I'm talking about literature, because it reflected the social thinking conditions of Great Britain, especially England, in the early half of 19th century. In such a context, having read Marx, Swamiji makes a statement, half a loaf is better than no bread. Again, another statement, every orthodoxy has a sacred duty to perform, namely to dig its own grave. The earlier it does it, the better for it. The longer it delays it, the worse death it will die. These are statements of Vivekananda. Mind you, a great spiritual leader, the prophet of Vedanta. So you can see Swamiji's reach, intellectual reach, and range of ideas. But remember, Swami Vivekananda emphasized again and again that human society progresses through evolution and not revolution, not through class struggle but class harmony. So that's where he differed from the traditional political anarchists and revolutionary thinkers of 19th century. He said, Revolution is destructive when it happens, and much more destructive after it is over. You can think of French Revolution and the bloodbath that followed, and elsewhere. So revolution is destructive when it happens, and much more destructive after it is over. But evolution is creative, constructive, progressive. A society progresses from a state which is comparatively backward towards a state which is much more advanced, much more spiritual, much more creative, much more harmonious, much more peaceful, much more settled. So I'm just giving an example, because Swami Vivekananda had studied modern European history, and he was very well versed in the contemporary 19th century European socio-economic political thought systems, especially sociology and politics. And his knowledge of world history, European history and Indian history, was very profound. The second very important element of Swami Vivekananda's concept of nation building or society building was his own experiences, which he gathered when he traveled all over India as a wanderer from 1886 to 1893, May, when he started his journey towards Vancouver, of course, eventually to attend the Parliament of World Religion in 1893. Sri Ramakrishna passed away in 1886, and then he started wandering all over India. And he could see a great nation, a nation which was once upon a time great. That would be a much more accurate way of putting it, in the light of 19th century India, which he saw. Swamiji knew about Indian history, a nation which had already become an advanced civilization long before Buddha was born, in 6th century BC. A nation which produced the great grammarian in 9th century BC, Panini. And a nation which produced so many ancient astronomers, Aryabhatta, Varahamihira, Bhaskara, medical scientists, you know, these teachers of modern Ayurveda, Indian school of traditional medicine, many of them lived around the first millennium BC. So there's the antiquity of this nation. But in 19th century, he saw a different country, a nation which had become poor, which had become divided, and which had gone backward in education, with women education discouraged, literacy low, level at very low rate. About 73% of Indian population in the late 19th century was living under the poverty line, as we understand it today. Though, of course, at that time, the index was not yet so well pronounced or defined. So the contrast between the India that he read about in the history books, in the ancient Vedantic textbooks, and the India that he saw in front of his own eyes, the contrast between these two. So that made him think, why this happened? How was it that a nation which was so great once upon a time had gone down so much today? So a great spiritual heritage alone cannot preserve or create a healthy society. So Swamiji wanted that we must combine, blend together some of the great teachings of modern political thinkers, values like democracy, egalitarianism, freedom of speech, women emancipation, social welfare ideas, looking after the poor and orphans, spreading literacy among the masses, bringing up the poor, equality not by bringing the rich to the down, down, but rather raising the poor to the rich means. There are two types of equality. You can crush everyone, that will be equal distribution of poverty. But equal distribution of property is possible by raising the poor to the towards the rich and not by leveling everyone down. So that's it. He took a stand which is just the opposite of what 19th century European political thinkers thought about equality, which was destructive at the time of implementation and destructive after its implementation is complete, as we already witnessed by the terrible fate of Soviet Union, China, and other nations. So Swamiji said, revolution is not the means, the evolution is the means for social progress. Evolution is constructive, creative. It is a progression from poverty to prosperity. It is a problem-solving mechanism, evolution. Revolution is a destructive mechanism, and it brings in, it retains the old problems and creates new problems. These are some of very, very radical ideas coming from a spiritual teacher. Another important aspect that influenced Swamiji's political thought and sociological ideas was his own training under his teacher, spiritual teacher, Sri Ramakrishna. So this is a great contrast. You have here a student who is almost an agnostic, who studies and discusses the teachings of Marx and Engels, as it was fashionable in the late 19th century academic circles of Calcutta. Not too many, but a few, discussing the origin of species of Charles Darwin and the anarchical ideas emanating from mid-19th century Russian thinkers. This is a fashion. Such a person goes to Sri Ramakrishna, who practically was the embodiment of India's 5,000 years of spiritual evolution. Sri Ramakrishna lived in the ancient times, maybe in 4th millennium BC, spiritually speaking. He was the embodiment of the spiritual teachings enshrined in the Vedic literature, which took their present form around 4th or 5th millennium BC. And he was the one who taught Swami Vivekananda, who was very modern, very radical, and very, very aggressive in using modern tools of logic and analysis in understanding the problems of society. But Vivekananda became a spiritual prophet and also a spiritual social reformer under the training from Sri Ramakrishna. So Sri Ramakrishna gave him something which he could not get from books. He could not get from Darwin. He could not get from modern political thinkers. Sri Ramakrishna gave him the cream of India's spiritual tradition, which he himself had experienced. So these are the three important aspects that defined, that formulated Vivekananda's ideas related to social reform and nation building. One, his own close acquaintance with world history, especially European history and Indian history, and especially the sociological, political thought currents emanating from 19th century Europe, and his own understanding of the ancient spiritual heritage of Indian society. Two contrasting pictures of human civilization at two ends, polar ends. The second factor, his training under Sri Ramakrishna, spiritual training under Sri Ramakrishna, which transformed an agnostic intellectual into a spiritual teacher. The third factor was his first-hand knowledge of India's problems, because he did think of reforming a nation. He didn't think about the problems of ordinary people who constitute a social structure before he realized the plight of people living in the villages, in the small towns of 19th century India, where he encountered illiteracy, superstition, poverty, and along with that, some sublime symbols of spirituality and culture and intellectual tradition. Because he met many great scholars, saints. Among them, there were princes, there were sages, and also there were beggars even. In such great human specimens, he could get an idea of the ancient India, the country that produced Buddha, Shankara, and so on. So these three contracting factors. Now, as I mentioned earlier, what was his solution to problems of society? I mentioned this very important thing, that is, he did not believe in radical social reform. Social reform should come from within, and it should not be imposed from outside. When social reform is imposed upon society, we call it revolution. When it gradually emerges from within the social structure, we call it evolution. Evolution is progression towards a higher state of affairs of society. Evolution, as I mentioned, is constructive, productive, and creative. It doesn't disturb the existing system. In spiritual traditions, in the history of spiritual traditions, this may be much more easily demonstrated. For example, the evolution of spiritual philosophy of people in the Middle East, let us say, from Old Testament to New Testament, from Moses to Jesus, you can see an example of evolution. You compare the teachings of the old Hebraic prophets, their angry words, their uncompromising temperament. You contrast it with the more humane, much more, palatable, much softer tones that you find the teachings of Jesus. So there is an evolution, that's a view of many critical thinkers of theology. I mean, the same tradition evolves from one stage to another stage, becomes more universal, more humane. So he believed not in revolution, but evolution. Again, as I mentioned, he did not believe in class struggle, but he believed in class harmony. How he developed this concept of harmony, we'll discuss in detail. In the process of this harmony, he thought society will be able to blend together, harmonize together, extreme contrast of ideologies and thought currents. For example, the best of science and technology, the best of modern management methods, the best of the modern Western ideas like innovation, self-reliance, taking up a new idea and experimenting it without facing the challenges of conservatism. All these positive egalitarianism, as I mentioned, democracy, freedom of speech, equality, all these should be blended together with ancient spiritual values. There should be no friction, harmonious, friction-free blending together of values and concepts which appear to be mutually contradictory but really are not contradictory. I can give one example. How actually he implemented in his own scheme. He know Swami Vivekananda founded Ramakrishna Mission, of which Vedanta Society is a branch. This Ramakrishna mission is historically a continuation of a monastic tradition of which Buddha was a member. Vardhamana Mahavira, who lived in the 6th century BC, was another member. Both of them lived in 6th century BC. And this was reformed. It was given a new orientation, new organization structure by Shankaracharya in 8th century. And what Vivekananda did when he founded Ramakrishna Mission was to give the same monastic tradition a modern orientation. You know, the old wine cannot be kept in an old bottle. So the old wine may require, of course, I'm just an example, old wine may, I'm not familiar with the whole process, you know, but still giving just an illustration what I read from books. Old wine cannot be kept in old bottles. It may need a new bottle, a new label perhaps, and new methods of advertising for marketing. But the contents should remain the same. That's what he did. He retained all his glorious traditions of monasticism, which are as old as the Vedas, which made Buddha a monk, which are reformed by Shankaracharya in 8th century. The same monastic tradition was given a new orientation by Vivekananda. But he did not break any of his vital fundamental values. That means the content remained the same, but the label was new. To give an example, when he formulated rules and regulations for admitting people to Ramakrishna order as monks, he was as strict as an ancient Vedic teacher who might have lived in 4th century BC. The fundamental values, teachings and disciplines remained the same, which were again reinforced and formulated by Shankaracharya in 8th century. But then, in the way it functions, in the way it really operates in this modern age, is slightly different. Different only to make it suitable to modern times. So that's why I said, Swamiji believed not in revolution, but evolution. Evolution is a productive, creative, constructive process that emerges from within. It is not a change that is imposed from outside before the field is ready. It is rather a natural process of growth and evolution from within. In evolution, there is harmony. There is no friction. In revolution, of course, you know how terrible it could be. You can read Carlyle's History of French Revolution. You can read about the Bolshevik Revolution, what happened in China, Cultural Revolution. Every revolution practically worsened the situation. In its attempt to reform by imposing change from outside, it practically destroyed everything. Both the cause and effect were equally destructive. So that's a uniqueness of Vivekananda's contribution to modern sociology. Of course, in the process, he articulates some new ideas, which again are new only from a modern perspective, which are all ideas enshrined in India's Vedantic literature. For example, he says, a society doesn't move in straight line. So in other words, as you find, he totally rejected the Hegelian concept of dialectical progression, which is the system that embodies. In Hegel's philosophy of history, the system is essentially that of dialectical progression. The model begins with an existing element or a thesis with contradictions inherent in the structure. These contradictions create the opposite of the thesis or antithesis, bringing about a period of conflict between the two. So as a result of this thesis and antithesis, a situation and its response, which creates friction and conflicts, the society moves in a straight line. That was, hey, that at least I don't have enough time. This is just interesting to compare this. It's a dialectical progression. Now, Swamiji, on the other hand, believed in cyclicism. Now, what is cyclicism? Human civilization moves in cycles, rotating cycles. Cycles of social movements. That's what he said. And all human progress, or civilizational evolution, as we call it, it's a complicated term, it functions and operates in rises and falls. It goes up and it comes down only to go up, like a wave. It's called wave theory. In the process, he gives a new interpretation to the concept of casteism in India. That is the most, what is called, Varnasrama Dharma. That's a very, very interesting contribution coming from Vivekananda. In Indian society, if you look at Vedic literature, you find the society was divided into four groups. Generally speaking, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. The priests, the philosophers, the contemplatives, the soldiers or the administrators, the traders, artisans, and also those who do service, menial work. Four groups of society. Now, if you read any book on sociology related to Indian history, you find this structure, as it later degenerated into, became birth-oriented, creating vertical barriers, not horizontal barriers. Horizontal barriers means, in an egalitarian society like America or today's Europe, not Europe medieval times, but today's Europe, if you are rich, if you are educated, you can move from one class to another class. You can take whatever profession you want. That's the glory of modern democracy, egalitarianism, based on the opportunity or the equality of opportunity for all. But during the medieval times, in India, almost like Europe, even Europe, only those who belong to certain classes were allowed to become the members of the Church of England, the senior clergy of the Anglican Church, or the Speaker of the House of Lords. Were not allowed for everyone. That is the vertical barrier. You are born into something and you are that. You cannot move. But in horizontal barriers, you can cross over by graduating, by moving forward, but acquiring qualities. You can make yourself greater and greater by your own effort. That's why, one sociologist said, in India there is caste, in Europe it is class, in America it is cash. But cash is better than caste, because cash creates only horizontal barriers. If you are born a pauper, you can become a trillionaire and you can be as great as whatever you, as we are already seeing today. But in Europe, class was the fundamental vertical barrier. You born into a class, you are that. In India, it was still worse, caste. So what happened, this situation created serious problems. Lack of dignity of labor, prejudices and privileges associated with these vertical barriers functioning as the institution of casteism. This created a lot of problems. As Vivekananda saw with his own eyes as he traveled all over India, from 1886, the year Sri Ramakrishna passed away, to 1893, the year in which he started his journey to America to attend the Parliament of Religion. So then he thought, and as a student of Sanskrit who has read the original scriptures, he knew that these vertical barriers did not exist during Vedic times. If you read the Upanishads and Vedas, which I've been practically doing that from my fifth year onwards, you don't find this kind of vertical barriers. Anyone can become a Brahmin or a Kshatriya by acquiring those qualities, by acquiring those tendencies. And it's a matter of spiritual cultural evolution. If you become a contemplative person, if you start living a contemplative life, if you devote your whole lifetime to philosophy, as Max Müller, who lived in the 19th century, you can become a Brahmin. And if you want to enlist yourself as part of draft, join, you can, if you fight for your country, you can become a Kshatriya, the caste of warriors. And if, on the other hand, you want to start a business, you become a Vaishya. And if you don't care for these things, if you don't go to school, if you are satisfied with some menial jobs, well, you can make a Shudra. So this was the system that existed during the early Vedic period in the Mahabharatas and almost till about 6th century AD. But then onwards, the situation began to change. So it was horizontal till 6th century, then it became vertical. Based on birth became the criterion for judging whether you are a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya. So the Swami Vivekananda knew that. So he says the ancient tradition should be brought back. Anyone can become a Brahmana, a contemplative philosopher. Anyone can join the army if you are physically, in the other respect, you're qualified. Or you can start a business. Similarly, in the same family, there could be any number of people. So this was Swami Vivekananda's. And he says, if we can reinstitute this structure where everyone can feel free to move forward by working hard in spirit, what means by acquiring the necessary qualifications to become a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. You can become a philosopher. If you can become a spiritual person, if you retire, if you go to a place and spend the rest of lifetime in contemplation of God, you are a Brahmana. If you join the army, you are a Kshatriya. If you start a business, you are a Vaishya. That's all. Nothing beyond that. Just as it is now in America. A kind of egalitarianism, democratic equality. And Swamiji says, this is a natural process of human evolution. Everyone can start from where he or she stands today. You can acquire those qualities and move forward in your life. Because spirituality is the basis of this evolution and change. Otherwise, we know what happens. This institution can become a curse of human society. It imprisons you. You are born into a structure, and that structure becomes a terrible prison wall. You cannot get out of it. It becomes a trap. Because he gives a detailed analysis of these four classes. He says, when the majority of people are contemplatives, then that society will give more emphasis to knowledge, wisdom, spirituality, ethics, and so on. When the majority of people in a society become more active, like Kshatriyas, the caste of warriors, that society may become aggressive. There will be more of equality, but can become aggressive. Now, there is also a danger. Very often, these classes will make their group that they may monopolize all powers and knowledge and tools of progress within their structure. So that's why Swamiji says, when in Brahminical culture, Brahminical tradition, there is an emphasis, a stress on knowledge and higher spiritual values, but there will be a lot of exclusivism, orthodoxy, leaving others out. Even when others are spiritually willing and equally qualified. In Kshatriya system, there could be a lot of cruelty, aggression. When the majority of people are traders, or when the social values are determined and dominated by values related to trade and commerce, there would be a lot of exploitation. And when the majority of people are interested only in work as such, manual work, there would be a degradation of higher values, philosophy, spiritual traditions, all this may take a back seat. So what is needed is each system has its own advantage. In the Sudra tradition, there is perfect equality, democracy. So that good point, that plus point, that great, that factor can be blended together with the emphasis for spiritual values which you find in Brahminical system, the dynamism and activism that you find in Kshatriya system, and the expansion of wealth and equal distribution of wealth among all people as you find in the Vaishya system. So each system has its own advantages, and also there are possible pitfalls also. It could degenerate into a monopoly, in which case it becomes a prison. Casteism can become a prison. Otherwise, it can become a productive, creative force which allows anyone or everyone in the world to move forward, but not without acquiring qualifications. Swamiji insisted again and again. Everyone should work hard to acquire those qualifications. Those who are contemplative by nature, not by pretensions, but those who lead such a contemplative life and ready to sacrifice and make the renunciation. Such people can become Brahmins. See, I can give an example. I know this very well. You know, in one ancient Vedic school in India, they announced that we will teach the Vedas to everyone. But at one point, you children should be willing to get up in the morning at 4 o'clock and take bath in cold water. And they should be willing to work hard reciting the ancient Vedas from 5 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock in night. So that they were not willing to do. So if for acquiring those, that status, you should also be willing to make the sacrifices necessary for it. As we do, you know, if you want to go to Stanford, you work hard. Otherwise, you go to some other schools. Similarly, when we work hard through evolution, again, you should remember, Swamiji insisted again and again, not through radical changes imposed from outside, but rather gradual changes coming from within through growth. Each and every individual, anyone and everyone can move forward in social structure. Anyone can become a contemplative, a philosopher, maybe a trader, depending upon his aptitude and also the qualifications that he's willing to work hard to achieve. That was his very interesting contribution to modern sociology. So that's why, many modern sociologists have contrasted Swamiji's contribution to sociology with Marx's contribution. So Marx talked about historical scientific materialism, dialectical materialism, historical dialectical materialism. But what Swamiji taught was historical scientific spirituality. By acquiring spiritualities, one can move forward. Not by forcibly acquiring things by using through the use of violence, but rather through inner growth. This should be the key for the progress and evolution of human civilization, human culture, and values. That's what we call the rotating cycles of human civilization. It's a very, very interesting contribution that Swamiji made. So that's why, you know, you can see these two schools of determinism. Swamiji believed in some kind of cyclic evolution in contrast to economic determinism of Karl Marx or dialectical progression of Hegel. So two contrasting ideas which are so dialectically, essentially different from Vivekananda's approach. So Hegel talks about dialectical progression, and Marx talks about economic determinism, because he was trying to solve the problem of what he considered to be the drawbacks of utopian socialism of Freud or Robert Owen and other thinkers of the early half of 19th century. Swamiji says that one can move forward through this spiritual evolution, which is creative. I can just give a few quotations from him. The same one great force is manifesting itself as political independence with the French, as mercantile genius in expansion of the sphere of equity with the British, and as the desire for liberation or spiritual independence with the Hindu. Vivekananda says, you know, every nation, every society has some uniqueness, some unique contribution to make the totality of human civilization. Every society has its own genius, its own area of specialization, not by choice, but by its own evolution and growth. See, he gives, for example, the ideas, political independence with French. He was very, very familiar with the political landscape of France before the French Revolution, and he was very familiar with the works of Rousseau and many of the French political thinkers who have made contribution to French political thoughts. Here he quotes from Voltaire and Rousseau profusely. So he says each nation has its own uniqueness about it. So he says the idea of political independence with the French, mercantile genius and expansion of this sphere of equity with the British, you know. So somebody, an Englishman most probably, boasted the sun doesn't set in the British Empire. So a non-Britisher retorted, that's because even God doesn't trust the Englishman in the dark. He may take away God's throne also. If you turn your back, the Englishman will take away whatever you have got. So even God doesn't trust the Englishman in the dark. That's why he keeps the sun burning everywhere all the same, keeping the flash light. So, but then Swamiji recognizes their great genius in trade, mercantile genius, and expansion of trade. He's talking about the English East India Company, you know, which actually was signed by Queen Elizabeth I, which practically, you know, inaugurated a new era of economic expansion in modern Europe, making all the tools of industrial revolution and the discovery of colonial lands, you know, the colonies, distant colonies. So that's why he said the history of civilization is the progressive reading of spirit into matter. This is another very interesting definition of history. So there is a gradual unfoldment, gradual and greater manifestation of the inner spirit in every society. Every society has its own genius, and when that society perfects that GDS, the area of specialization. It is higher and higher manifestation or unfoldment of its own inner force, which is an expression of the divine spirit that is present in every social structure, social mindset. That's why he said, the expedition of the human soul for salvation is the history of mankind. So mankind is on an expedition for the unfoldment of spirituality that is present in every social psyche. Now, if you can look upon history and society from this perspective, you find there is no need of any conflicts. Any kind of radical change imposed from outside, violating the essential structure of what it seeks to change, will only create more problems. And for that, he says the four yogas, for example, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga. These are four tools, four methods that individuals of any society can use to perfect and go forward with its own area of specialization. But for that, every individual in the society should be willing to work constructively, creatively to acquire those qualities. You don't have to ask. When you reach the point, you just become that. See, a student studying fifth grade, if he gets top grade, then he cannot go and sit the fourth grade again. He doesn't have to. He can automatically go to the sixth grade. So when we acquire those qualities through creative growth and evolution, without trying to put a brand name and without trying to impose a radical change or reform from outside, then there's a gradual evolution and growth, which is silent, natural, and spontaneous. Otherwise, any attempt to bring about a change in society will always be destructive. But, one very, very important aspect that he repeats again and again, all these modern values are wonderful. Swami Vivekananda was a great admirer of American nation in one aspect. That is the democratic values, the egalitarianism, the freedom of speech, equality of opportunity. Of course, historians won't agree with me because that process is still going on. And there were many things yet to be done in 20th century. And Vivekananda wrote and spoke in 19th century. But still, compared to what he saw elsewhere, he found American society was far ahead of many other parts of the world in evolving a unique socio-economic political system where democracy, equality of opportunities, egalitarianism, freedom of speech, innovation, willingness to take a new idea and experiment with it were natural. So he was a great admirer of it. But he also said, it is very good, but it is not perfect. There are many more things to be added to this to make that system more stable and to prevent it from collapse. That certain spiritual ideas are necessary. Very often we disown the past. And Vivekananda was a great upholder of the idea. We cannot really disown the past. Because the present is a continuation of the past, not exact repetition, no doubt. No, it's not an exact repetition. But the present cannot be detached from the past. It can happen in a political structure, of course. America could detach itself from Britain and George III. And the poor man went mad, of course, as a result. But the point is, that could happen. But a perfect egalitarian society with high levels of innovation and democracy is wonderful, but those systems itself, themselves, may not last unless you add a spiritual content in it. So he said, along with democracy, along with modern technology, innovation, organizational genius, we must also have a spiritual paradigm. And in this, in fact, one of great thinkers of modern times, you know, is Julian Huxley. He incorporates in his work, it's from a talk, The Evolutionary Vision, delivered in 1959 at the closing session of the Chicago University Symposium on Evolution After Darwin. It's from Julian Huxley. So Julian Huxley incorporates Swamiji's ideas. Man's evolution is not biological, but psychosocial. And if you read further, you find Julian Huxley practically lands in what we call Vedantic ideas, which he didn't call by that name. It operates by the mechanism of cultural tradition, which involves the cumulative self-production and self-variation of mental activities and their products. Accordingly, major steps in the human phase of evolution are achieved by breakthrough to new dominant patterns of mental organization of knowledge, ideas, and belief, ideological instead of physiological, spiritual instead of biological. So very interesting observation you find. Of course, now we have gone backward from that era of Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley woke up, you know, people woke up in those days after the Second World War. So people were in need of some kind of spiritual food wherever it's available. But today, so many decades after Second World War, modern human society may not be fully able to appreciate many of the profound statements of thinkers who read Vivekananda during the 1950s and 60s, or even the 1940s, who suddenly recognized the need and recognized the new spiritual paradigm that they found in Vivekananda's works. And in the process, he also articulates some new ideas for human society as a whole. He says, for example, the question of religion is discussed elaborately in Vivekananda's sociological ideas. What's the role of religion? Even for those who don't believe in God, religion is very much a part of their life. You may not believe in God, but you are living with people who may belong to different faith traditions. So he says, if you look beyond the differences, contradictions, you can always find a common ground in all religious traditions. In every religious tradition, there are two levels. One, the primary level, which are superficial, which are related to the socio-anthropological aspects of the prophets, of the society in which the prophet is born, the society to which that prophet preached. See, every prophet will have in his teachings some aspects which are only of contemporary relevance, for example, which are related to conventions and customs and traditions of that particular era, which may not have any universal value. So in every holy scripture, you find many ideas which others may not necessarily consider as holy. So those are ideas related to contemporary social conventions and traditions and customs and habits. But if you look beyond that or beneath them, you find there are many wonderful spiritual ideas which are universal in nature, which have got a universal appeal, going beyond the limitations of time and differences in terms of climate, weather, era, customs and traditions and conventions. If you look beyond the secondary details, then you find there are some essentially universal spiritual ideas enshrined in every single holy scripture. They constitute what he called universal religion. They are common for the whole humanity. If you read Upanishads, and then if you read Eckhart, you find Eckhart practically, more or less, says the same thing which you find in the Upanishads, the same idea of one attributeless, universal divine spirit, which he tries to explain through the path of negation. You know, if you read the Mandukya Upanishad, Nanta Prajnam, Nabhish Prajnam, Ubhayada Prajnam, you find this, the same ideas. Eckhart says there are certain levels beyond the level of duality. When you pursue God as one universal attributeless spirit, which cannot be explained, which beyond description and definition, which beyond verbalization. So, in every holy scripture, in the teachings of every great spiritual teacher, you find many universal spiritual ideas, which are relevant and important for the whole humanity of all times, all ages, all nations, for the whole human society, which Vivekananda said constitutes what we call universal religion. It's universal. And the essence of the universal religion is spirituality, which actually goes beyond religion as we understand the word in conventional terms. How to practice this? He called it practical Vedanta. If we can look upon our own individual life as a spiritual journey, as a pilgrimage, whatever we do with words, deeds, and thoughts, as an offering to God, then every moment becomes an occasion for practicing spirituality. Every thought becomes a meditation, and the whole life gets spiritualized. The secular gets merged in the spiritual. So there are many wonderful ideas in Vivekananda's literary writings and lectures with regard to his vision of an ideal society. But the fundamental basis, the foundation of all those ideas, is spirituality. That's why, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in contrast to materialist thinkers, Swamiji rejected the economic determinism of Marx and dialectical progression of Hegel, and he would have called his idea as historical scientific spirituality in contrast to Marxian idea of historical dialectic materialism. It is historical dialectic or historical spirituality, scientific spirituality, or dialectic spirituality, not dialectic materialism. That was Swamiji's unique contribution. Thank you. So it's a very elaborate subject. You know, in the process, we have to look at Swamiji's words through the prism of later political thinkers. Then only you'll be struck by the uniqueness of Vivekananda's concept of an ideal society. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Namaste.